originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I would like to thank everyone listening to us here on the Horse Racing Radio Network on Sirius 219, XM 206, and also to those of you listening to our website, that's horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to some 60 former riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. Please, if you are able to help, visit their website. That's www.pdjf.org. So our guest tonight won the Derby on a 15-1 long shot purchased for $6,500 in 1970. That was Dust Commander. And he set records for number of wins in a season at Tampa. He won 5 races on a single day at Turfway, not once, but 5 separate times, multiple riding titles, and in total he won 2,598 victories. It is a pleasure to introduce jockey Mike Manganiello. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So great to have you here, Mike. And you're living here in Lexington now, is that right?
Yes, I do.
Good place to be. I'm here in studio right now. But you were born in Hartford, Connecticut. Not really horse country. But
no, it's not. But there's a lot of racing close by.
True. True. Were you born into a racing family?
No, I was the only one interested in racing. I was the black sheep of the family.
You and me both, Mike. Now, when did you get your first introduction to racing?
Well, I was introduced to racing by a sports editor at the Hartford Times. He introduced me to some racing officials at Narragansett Park in Rhode Island. And they, in turn, put me in touch with a trainer named Odie Clullin, who was known to turn out a lot of riders. And I stayed with him, and he started me out riding.
Odie Clullin. I am very familiar with that name, Mike. I went to Chris McCarron's jockey school, and he was one of those riders you just mentioned that came up under Odie Clullin as well. So Odie definitely had a talent for producing talented riders.
Yeah. He was a good trainer, a good teacher, and he used to ride horses himself, race horses.
That had to be beneficial, learning from someone who also not just trained, but he rode.
Yes, it was. He's an interesting person. He had a lot of knowledge about racing and riding.
How old were you when you went to go work for him?
I was 15 years old, and I worked for the summer at Summer in 56. And went back to school, come back when I was 16, I wound up staying with him. I quit school, actually, but I was entered into school when I went to New Orleans with him. And I just never did finish because it just took too much time with my duties as, you know, trying to learn to be a writer.
Well, that was obviously your main focus. I don't know about you, Mike, but I didn't like sitting in class when I wanted to be out with the horses. And what did your family think of that, though, whenever you decided to quit school and pursue riding?
Well, actually, the deal with my parents was I was supposed to finish school.
Uh-oh.
but I never did. But they were very supportive of what I wanted to do, and that made it good.
Were you an only child, or did you have a big family? Or
No, I had four other brothers and a sister. There were six of us.
And you were the...
I was the oldest boy, and my sister was the oldest of all of us.
And so you quit school. You're working for Odie Cleland. And tell us what you did when you first started working for him. Obviously, you were green and had to learn the ropes. What did he teach you from
right.
the very beginning?
Well, I had some riding knowledge, but not with racehorses. What I'd done first was, the basic duties of rubbed horses, cleaned out the stalls and cooled them out and walking them around after they exercised. And eventually I moved up to exercising horses. And I did that for a couple of years, actually three. And then I rode my first race at Narragansett in 1959.
You mentioned you had some riding knowledge prior to going to the racetrack. What did you ride as a kid, or what did you do?
Well, no, I just whenever I was able to ride a horse or go to these riding schools that they had where you could rent horses and go out riding and mess around, or if I was on the farm and there were some work horses around, or I just ride anything that had four legs.
And when did that idea first come into your mind? You mentioned the connections you had who set you up with Odie Cleland, but when did the idea of becoming a rider actually come into your mind?
Well, I had several people from time to time say, well, small as you are, you ought to be a jockey. And that always, was interesting to me because, you'd see the movies where they had movies of horse racing, and that got me interested in that. And when I was able to talk with someone that actually would be able to get me into racing, well, that, I just liked that even more.
And then you're working for Odie, and you worked for him for several years. You mentioned when it came time for you to start getting on horses, galloping and breezing horses, did that come pretty naturally to you?
Well, the riding part, yes, but there were a lot of different ways of controlling horses that were different from the horses I used to ride, so I had to learn that. And like the horses I used to ride, they would, a lot of them would neck rein, mm-hmm. But the, thoroughbreds, they don't neck rein. You had to use a little more strength and pulling them one way or the other, and some did it easily and some were a little stubborn, but you had to learn that part of it.
And so a couple years of doing that, and you decided you were ready to ride races. And did you ask Odie what his thoughts were, if you were ready, and why did you feel like you were?
I let him make all them decisions. He told me when I was ready.
Oh.
So, and of course, if it was up to me, I would have rode a lot sooner than what I did, but I wasn't ready.
Right.
So I left all them decisions up to him. When he said, I was ready, then I was pretty anxious about that.
And so I know back in the day, obviously now we don't do this. We have agents and we go out and we seek mounts, but back in the day you had contracts with a trainer.
Yes.
And so was your contract with him.
And to me the contracts were good, but the contracts were being abused by some people. So what the contract did was the trainer that had your contract, he would more or less make the decision as to when he thought you were ready to ride, as opposed to now all you have to do is pass some basic tests, be approved by the racing officials to go ahead and ride, rather than a trainer who was taking a bigger interest in you. So now people are able to ride a lot sooner than they're really ready to,
mm-hmm.
In my opinion. I think the contract was a good thing.
Well, let me ask you this question, Mike. Do you think you also, and we'll talk about this later, but after you rode, you spent much time as a racing steward. Do you think that the process for becoming a rider nowadays is just simply too easy and they need to make stricter rules and have...
Exactly. I think it is a little bit too easy. Of course, eventually them riders that are riding before they're ready, they'll eventually become, ready to ride, but it is too easy and you know, becomes more dangerous at times.
Do you have any ideas of how to make that process more difficult?
No, not really. I don't know how you would correct that.
Yeah.
Other than the people approving riders, they just need to be a little more strict about it. And the problem you have with that is the way the rules read, as long as they meet them requirements, whether you think they're ready or not, you got to approve them. Otherwise, you know, you discriminate against them. You know, it's the way the laws are.
Well, I know now, Mike, they do have certain rules when you start riding. Some states are different, but some states you can't use a stick. Some states you can't ride a first time, or some states you can't ride on the grass. Did they have any rules like that when you started out?
No, I don't recall. There may have been certain tracks maybe that may have had that, but no, that's part of what you're supposed to be able to do. So, I mean, no sense in taking your whip away. You got to be able to learn how to use one properly.
Right. Yeah, that rule never really made sense to me either, Mike. But you actually won your very first race on a first-timer.
Yes, I did. She was a two-year-old, first-time starter. It was in New Orleans, and I think it was 5/16 of a mile straight away down the chute, out of the chute from the head of the stretch. The trainer told me, he said, just don't fall off. He said, just hang on, and she'll take care of you. And she sure did. She went to come out of there, and she went to the lead and kept going, and she went by a length, somewhere like that.
Was obviously that was your first winner. Was she green at all, given that it was her first start?
No. Usually, Odie, when he trained horses, they were broke pretty well, and you know, they went through a lot of the training procedures where, you know, they didn't run green. They were pretty educated.
And so, had you been working her in the morning quite frequently?
Yes, I was getting on her quite often in the mornings, got familiar with her, and she got familiar with me, and she did it for me.
Did they, back then, I know now we have that initiation process where they, all the jocks, the older jocks come out and they throw buckets of water on you and throw eggs and baby powder and God knows what else. Did they do that for you back then?
Yes, they did. It's just something, an initiation process, and you know, they're a little more they get a little more carried away today than they did then, but you know, it's all an initiation process.
Who were some of the older riders riding with you back then at Narragansett?
Let's see, there was Norm Mercier, Daryl Madden, which happened to be a nephew of Odie Clellan. He was a very good rider, and he helped me out a lot. There's a rider called Billy Scoose, David DeRoyne. I can't think of them all right now, but they're, you know, they all tried to help you.
And Narragansett, of course, unfortunately, no longer in existence. What? And I've never been there and don't know anything about it. So tell me what that racetrack was like and what it was like riding there.
Well, I don't know. I can exactly tell you what it was like. It's just a racetrack like any other racetrack. And, you know, I don't know what more I could say about that.
Was it a mile track?
I wasn't paying a whole lot of attention to that part at that time when, you know, I was just excited about being able to ride.
Makes sense, Mike. And how long did you stay there for?
Let's see. I stayed there for a couple, rode there for a couple of years, and I lost my apprenticeship, and I moved my tack out to Ohio, Cleveland, Ohio, at a racetrack called Thistle Downs, which is now still racing. And I rode there for several years, had a lot of success there, and eventually moved my tack down to Kentucky, and rode in Kentucky, Florida, and had quite a bit of success there. So I made that mostly my circuit, Florida, Kentucky, Chicago, and rode up east, back up east to Delaware in Liberty Bell for a while. And I just kind of moved around. Wherever my business took me, I went.
Gypsy lifestyle, Mike. Did you like that? Did you like moving around on the road a lot, or did it get old?
No, it never got old. I loved it. It was like an adventure, you know. Took you to a lot of places, met a lot of people, and, you know, they were all interesting places to me. I, you know, instead of just staying in one spot, to see the country a little bit.
What's your favorite racetrack you've ridden at?
Well, my favorite was, I'd have to say Churchill Downs and Keeneland. They were my favorites. They were nice. And also, I loved Florida Downs and what's now called Tampa Bay Downs. Mm-hmm. But at the time, it was actually Sunshine Park, and then they called it Florida Downs, and it's now Tampa Bay Downs. I loved going there for the winter because the winters were so mild there as opposed to riding up north here.
And you always just had so much success at Tampa. I mean, everywhere you did, but Tampa, you really did extraordinarily well at.
Yes, I did. For several years, I was leading rider there for several years, and I always did quite well. So that'll make you like a place.
That's true. And it's warm, too, right?
Yes, it is.
Makes it nice.
That's part of it.
A little warmer than Turfway Park in the wintertime.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've been there in the wintertime, too.
That's brutal. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. I want to back up a little bit. You mentioned you lost your apprenticeship and then you went to Ohio. How does that work with the contract that you had with Ole Kleland? Did that stay in effect after your apprenticeship was over, or?
No, I rode for a year under contract to Odie, and then he sold my contract to another owner that had a string of horses there in New England. And I rode for him for about another year, and then the contract ran out, and then you're out on your own. And so, you know, business got a little slow for me, and that's why I decided to move out to Ohio. And it turned out to be a good move because I did really well in Ohio. And so you had to just keep, you had to go where the business was, wherever you were doing. If you weren't doing good at one place, you tried somewhere else, tried somewhere new. And until, you know, you start getting on a roll and, you know, just start doing well.
So you said Odie sold your contract. I'm curious, how much would a jock's contract go for?
Well, I'm not sure. I never did know what he sold it for. might have been for a lot of money, and might have been for a ham sandwich, you know. I never did really know. But that's not uncommon for contracts to be sold at that time.
Mike, do you know when they stopped doing that, contracts?
You know, I don't really remember. It's sometime in the 60s, late 60s, I'd say. They stopped doing it, but I don't know exactly when that was.
Then you moved to Ohio, and did you have an agent lined up for you there, or did you just?
Well, I didn't have one lined up, but I wound up getting one there, and he was my agent for 13 years.
Wow!
And we really did well together. He was a good hustler; people liked him, and that's a big thing in racing. He never went back on his word when he gave a call. You know, he would make sure I honored that, and you know, so people liked him. He had a good reputation as, you know, being an agent, and you know, so we worked well together.
What was his name?
His name was Bob Peabody.
Did Bob keep you pretty busy in the mornings? Would you work a lot of horses or even gallop horses?
Oh, yeah, he'd make sure I stayed busy. He'd always have horses for me to be exercising and breezing. And, you know, I never stood still in the mornings.
Mike, did you have to work out other than getting on horses in the morning? Did you have to do that to help with your weight?
I never did. Just getting on your normal regimen in the morning, what you did was enough exercise for anybody to do. You know, you get on 15 horses a morning and you're bouncing from barn to barn, you're staying pretty fit right there.
Yeah, 15 would do that.
Yeah, it would. And, you know, there were a lot of times that's what I got on.
And then you go and you ride in the afternoon. I'm sure that, you know, in Ohio you were doing so well, you're probably riding the card.
Yeah, and he had me at that time. I think they had about 12 races up in Ohio a day. And so he would pretty much have me on the full card. I just, you know, there were very few times I sat out a race.
Wow, so, yeah, you're keeping busy every single every single day. And describe to us what your daily schedule would be like in those days. Would you get on 15 horses in the morning, and would you take a nap in the jocks room? Would you study the races? What would you do?
Well, yeah, sometimes, you know, I would come. It all depends on what race I started. Now, every day I didn't get on 15 horses, but I got on between 10 and 15 horses, you know, in the morning. If I happened to miss the first race, I'd go in early and maybe try to get a nap, and sometimes I didn't have enough time to take a nap.
Were you big on handicapping, looking at the form?
I was a bad handicapper, but, but no, I would. I'd study the racing form just to see what my opposition was, and, you know, just kind of get a little pre-race idea about what I wanted to do, and didn't, sometimes that didn't always work out, but, you know, it gives you something to do.
Well, and I'm sure when you're established at a particular racetrack, you get to know your other riders, so that has to be helpful as well. You know what they're going to do, most likely.
Yeah, you try to figure out what their moves are going to be and what their style is, and, you know, it all plays into the same thing, you know, just trying to read the race where how it's going to come up.
How would you describe your own riding style?
Well, I just try to fit my style into the way the horse liked to run. You know, I like taking horses from come from behind on horses. But if that's not the horse's style, well, then you gotta adapt and ride your horse the way the horse prefers to run. Some horses don't like to be rushed. Some of them run better when you just kind of sit on them and let them get their stride. And others, they like to be hustled. They like to be on a lead. And so, you know, you just adapt to the way the horse wants to run.
Yeah, I agree with you, Mike. I preferred to come from off the pace just because of the strategy involved. I got more of a rush out of that, passing horses left and right down the lane. But like you said, however they want to run, if they're gonna win, you know.
Yep, you just ride them the way they like to run, and you know, you just hope you stay out of trouble if you have to come from behind.
So Mike, you had so much success there in Ohio, and you rode there for several years. When and why did you decide to move your tack to Kentucky?
Well, my connections in Kentucky became great, you know, where there were a lot of good outfits in Kentucky that didn't go to Ohio. And so, you know, the decision where I got to ride better horses. And not only that, you know, that's the home of the Kentucky Derby, and everybody wants to ride in the Derby, whether they win it or not. It just, you know, everybody's looking for a Derby mount, and you couldn't get that. It's, you know, Kentucky was a better place to find that.
Well, rode in the Derby you did, Mike, and you rode in 5 Kentucky Derbies,
yeah,
actually, and your first was in 1968 aboard Tevega, and you also won the Ohio Derby that year with that horse.
Did. Mm-hmm. And that happened to be an Ohio horse, so my comment about that's where to go to ride a Kentucky Derby horse, well, that didn't prove out there, because this was an Ohio horse, T. Vega. He was Ohio-owned and trained by an Ohio trainer, and but this horse got really good and deserved a shot to run in the Derby, and he didn't disgrace himself. He finished 7th or 8th, in the middle of the pack. He didn't finish last. So he was an Ohio horse that got me in my first Derby.
Were you confident going into the Derby, given the fact that you had ridden him previously to great success? Were you fairly confident about your chances?
On T-Vega?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I knew he would run good. He wouldn't embarrass himself. To say, well, I thought I'd win it, well, that, you know, that's going a little far to say that, but I thought he would run good. He did run good. He didn't embarrass nobody. Now, the one I won, I was very confident in that horse. That's a different story. I really liked that his chances in there. I thought I had a really good chance to win it, and with Dust Commander, that is.
We'll talk about that in great detail in just a second, Mike. But what was it like with you aboard your very first Derby mount to Vega and walking out onto the track while they played My Old Kentucky Home? What was that feeling like?
Well, that's a feeling that gives you goosebumps. When you walk out on that track and you got the whole grandstand singing My Old Kentucky Home, and it just vibrates from within out and coming out of you. You know, it's just kind of a great feeling. And then when that's over, you go to warming up your horses. It's just, you know, all that leaves. And then it all becomes business.
Wow. And in that moment, do you think to yourself, I've made it? Even though, obviously, you hadn't won the race at that point. But was that, it had to be a satisfying feeling.
Well, it's another level that you reached in your dreams of, you know, getting to the top. Yes.
Tell me, Mike, what was T-Vega like to ride? What kind of a horse was he?
He's a very kind horse. He wasn't hard to ride. He, pretty much responded to whatever you asked him to do. He come from off the pace and not too far, but back a little ways, and he'd come running down that stretch, and he was really a nice horse to ride.
Did you have a clean trip in the Derby?
Yes, I did. I did. I have no trouble at all. I was able to move when I asked him to. I never got stopped, but I just didn't have enough horse.
Well, we'll talk about the Kentucky Derby victory you had 2 years later in just a minute. We are going to take a quick commercial break. Folks, stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigal, and I am joined tonight by jockey Mike Manganiello. Mike, let's talk about the 1970 Derby with Dust Commander. And Dust Commander was trained by Don Combs, who I know very well. And tell us how you first got the mount aboard that horse.
Well, I was riding to Keeneland in the spring, that spring, and Don Combs needed a rider for his horse, you know, Dust Commander, and some couple of prep races that he wanted to run in before the Derby. So he contacted my agent, and my agent, you know, got me the mount. He run the first week at the meet. It was a short race, and he finished about around fifth or sixth. And he come back a week later, the second week, and he run a mile and 16th, and he won it. And the following week, he put him in the Bluegrass Stakes on a mile and 1/8, and he win that one. So this horse run three times at Keeneland, three times in 3 weeks.
Wow.
And the Derby is like 9 days later. So he win the Bluegrass really easy. I mean, easy to me. He didn't win by that far, but it was an easy race for him. I really liked that horse in there. And he paid $75. I couldn't believe that nobody would bet on him. So the rest is history. You know, he run in a Derby. He went it by 5 lengths.
What did you tell Don Combs coming back after the Bluegrass when you got off the horse? What did you say to him?
Well, I said, I told him we got a good chance to win the Derby. And I said, the way he run that race, he ran exactly how I thought he would run. I mean, he's just so responsive whenever I asked him to run. And so, you know, the way he run, I knew he had to have a good chance, you know, to jump up and say, well, yeah, we're going to win the Derby. I mean, you know, that's a little bold. But I knew he had a good chance to win it. If we could stay out of trouble, we'd at least get a piece of it.
Now, there are some people who thought he just won the Bluegrass because it was a sloppy track that day.
Yeah.
And did that concern you at all, that he just took to the slop?
No. No, because the race before the Bluegrass, it was a fast racetrack, and he win that just easy. So I wasn't concerned about the fact that it was a sloppy track, because he could run on either sloppy or fast track.
You mentioned how responsive he was when you would ask him, what was his running style?
Well, Well, obviously, he's coming from off the pace, mm-hmm. not that far off the pace that he was in the Derby, but from back in the pack a little ways, he would come from off the pace, and he'd always finish strong. And I like that part about it, you know, being in the Derby, because, you know, you got all them horses that'll be stopping in front of you, and you just got to make sure you have some place to go.
I mentioned Don Combs. I went to Chris McCarron's jockey school, and Don was in the same barn there at the training center on Paris Pike here in Lexington. And just what a wonderful person he is. And what was he like riding for?
Oh, he was, you know, he'd tell you what he would like for you to do, or a certain style he'd like for his horse to run. And if it worked out that way, that was good. If it didn't, you improvised and just went on and, you know, rode the horse the way the race come up. So he was easy to ride for. I mean, he wasn't, he wasn't tough on you or nothing. He more or less relied on your ability and didn't try to make you do what he wanted to do. Just he knew you had to improvise at times.
Did you know the owners of Dust Commander?
Yes, Verna and Robert Lehman. In fact, right now we still stay in touch and we're very good friends.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Now, going into the Derby, you're all feeling pretty confident. I want to point out, according to the statistic I have here, that was Dust Commander's 23rd lifetime start, the Kentucky Derby. Now, you definitely don't see that nowadays, Mike.
No, you don't. Back then, horses ran more often. They ran pretty much weekly, or if not, at least 10 days apart. You know, that wasn't uncommon for a horse to do that. And in Dust Commander's case, he ran weekly up to coming up to the Derby. The biggest rest he got there was a 2 weeks rest between the Derby and the Preakness.
Wow. That's incredible. Why don't we see that anymore?
Well, I guess different training techniques. I really don't know the answer to that question. What the trainers nowadays, what their logic is on it, but it seems to work for them because their horses, I guess they think it's just too hard on a horse, and it very well may be. I'm not going to argue that point, but back then, racing was the same, and the horses seemed to stand up to the number of times that they raced in a year. And in the wintertime, a lot of times horses would, that's when they would get their break and lay up for a while and just start back in the spring. So I don't know what the logic is on it. It's they're lucky to run once a month.
Yeah. Well, Dust Commander obviously didn't mind the rigorous schedule, but going into the Derby, interesting story about the day of the Derby. If I do recall, the owner went to shoot a tiger, and then there was a blessing. Tell us the story.
Yeah, the blessing came at Keeneland. He blessed the horse in the paddock at Keeneland. It was blessed by the Archbishop from Africa, and they had become friends with this Archbishop, and the Archbishop was there for the running at at Keeneland for the bluegrass, and he blessed the horse then. So the owner, Robert Lehman, he had been, prior to the Derby, he had been up in I believe it was India. There was a man-eating tiger raiding the villages there, and he was hired by the government to kill the tiger. So he was up in a tree blind. He was there for several days, and he didn't want to come out till he got his tiger. Well, it just so happened that a day or two before the Derby, he happened to get kill the tiger, and he flew in the morning of the race, morning of the Derby. He got there just in time, you know, to come into the paddock. And what he had in his pocket, he had some neck bones. It's supposed to be good luck. He had them in his pocket because he pulled them out and he showed them to me. They were neck bones that brought good luck. So, so obviously it did bring some kind of luck.
Guess so, or just your riding ability is one of the two, Mike. I think it's probably the latter. But they were lucky, I guess. Now, you drew an inside post for the Derby, and yes, what was the strategy you had in your mind going into the race?
Well, the strategy is like I said before, you know, things change when you come out of that gate. I had intended on laying, you know, pretty close up, maybe fourth, fifth, somewhere in that range, and, just sit there for a while. But when you come out of the gate, I got slammed by the horse on the outside of me and knocked me to the inside. So I just took hold of my horse and let him get his stride back and settled back in about 9th or 10th on the rail. I stayed on the rail. And I just, when my horse started getting his momentum going, I just found a place for him to run in between horses and around horses and back down on the rail. But pretty much I was able to stay on the rail and not have to check my horse. And when we're coming around the turn, you know, I could feel him. Just he's getting faster and faster. And I haven't even urged him. I haven't tried to make him run at all. He's just doing this on his own. So we're turning for home, and I had to come off the rail a little bit. And there were two or three three horses in front of me, two or three, and I had they split a little bit, and I was able to come between both of them. And when I got up with them, I reached back and I hit my horse, and he just accelerated. Mm. And I reached back, cracked him again, and every time I smacked him, he would open up a length or two more. So I just went from there, and he just wind up going and winning by five lengths.
They say you have ice water in your veins, Mike, based on that ride, especially splitting horses, sticking to the rail for so long. And when you turn for home and you get that response from him when you're hitting him, do you hear the crowd?
Well, not really. I didn't hear the crowd. I could hear the horses behind me, but I didn't hear the crowd. I wasn't paying it out because I was concentrating on getting to that wire and maintaining my lead that I had wind up opening up on. And so I can't really say I heard the crowd till after I come back.
Did you allow yourself to get excited as you were closing in on the wire, or were you worried at that point?
Well,
and you didn't relax until...
I when we hit the eighth hole, the way he was running, I felt like there's no way anybody could be running fast enough to go by him, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at the same time, I'd still reach back and encourage him with the whip just to make sure that he maintained that the margin. And when we hit the wire, he was still trying to widen the lead.
Like I mentioned in the introduction, Mike, he was 15-1 that day. Who was the favorite that year?
My dad, George, was the favorite, and he wound up finishing second.
Oh. So, yeah, sure the owners and everyone who bet on Dust Commander were pretty happy with those odds.
And, oh, yeah. We were all pretty happy.
Yeah. Can't imagine that feeling of satisfaction. And tell us about the rest of Dust Commander's career following the Derby.
Well, following the Derby, he come back the next morning after the race. He had some filling in his leg, and it wasn't anything serious, but it caused him to miss a lot of training. So Don had, you know, thought about maybe just passing up the Preakness and running into the Belmont. The trainer, the owner just... was really looking forward to running him in a Preakness. So we wind up running him in a Preakness, and he ran up the third, turned it for home, and I could tell he was laboring. He didn't feel just right. So he wind up backing up and finishing seventh. They had to turn the horse out for a while. Because of that injury, you know, it just kind of agitated even more. So they had to give him some time off. After that, he never came back to the same horse that he was. So I rode him once after that, and that was it.
Now, did he go on to be a stallion?
Yes, he did. He stood, I think, three seasons here for the layman's, and... they sold him to Japan, and he stood for several seasons in Japan, and eventually came back here to the United States and was, you know, turned out.
Jockey Mike Manganiello joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike, I want to talk about an interesting story I read.
Okay.
That you rode with two broken arms. Is that true?
Well, yeah, basically it was. I was riding at Randall Park in Cleveland, I guess it was around 64, something like that. And my horse broke both legs and went down. And I hit the ground, and I thought I was all right. So I rode the following race. And didn't feel just right. I was experiencing some pain. But I continued to ride the following, the next race after that also. But during that race, I tried to reach back and hit my horse, and my wrist went limp, and my other arm was just hurting really bad. So I just kind of leaned on the horse's neck and just let him finish out the race and let the outrider pick me up and take me back. So I wind up going to the hospital, get x-rays, and I had a broken wrist and a broken elbow. So I had both of them in a cast for a while, and laid me up for about a month.
That's incredible. So, you must have a high pain tolerance.
Well, the fact that I hated to have to take off a horse, and I might have probably should have took off, and I said, I can ride him, and being in shock too, maybe they had something to do with it. I don't really know, but I did. I wind up having a broken wrist and a broken elbow.
Did you have any other serious injuries during your career?
I fractured a few vertebrae, had broken collarbone. I guess that, other than being banged up several other times, I think that's about that I can recall that I broke.
Mike, when and why did you decide to retire from riding?
Well, I got an opportunity in 1991 to go to Texas and become a steward. And so I didn't even think twice about it because it was getting close to where I needed to probably retire anyway. So I figured that was a good opportunity to do that. And I did. I became a steward, racing steward, and I did that all up until last year was my last year as a steward. I retired right now.
How old were you when you decided to retire from riding?
I was in my 50s.
And obviously after that long, illustrious career, understandable. And how did you enjoy being a steward?
Yeah, I did. Because I thought I could add to the steward stand, a little bit of insight, knowledge of the running of the race. And it worked out fine.
Well, I think it's very, very, very important to have at least one steward up in the stand who's a former jockey. And that
it's always a good idea. And possibly a trainer, which would help also. But you definitely getting the knowledge from a jockey, a former jockey, to be in a steward stand, the understanding the way the races run and what you can and cannot do and some of the, maybe some of the BS stories that you'd get for an excuse, which you get a lot. And you're an asset any way you look at it.
Right, you've probably heard all those stories before, maybe told even...
I probably said most of them. That was right.
Yeah. No, obviously you have to work with the other stewards you're there with, but were you strict when dealing out punishments days?
I wasn't strict, but I was consistent.
Yeah.
And that's what you got to be, consistent. If you let one slide by... and not the other, it's not good, If what's good for one is good for the other. You have to do it that way. And in order for somebody to get a suspension from the board of stewards I worked with, it had to be really bad, and bad in the fact of where it was dangerous for the other riders.
Mm-hmm.
So... I guess you could say some of them thought that we were strict, you had to be, in order to have safety out there, because It's a dangerous game, and you can't have careless people out there just getting a pass on everything, in my opinion.
Did you have too many run-ins with the stewards when you were riding?
Yeah, well, not many, but I've had some. I pretty much tried to stay out of their eyesight, but you know, you're gonna mess up. You ride that many horses, you're gonna mess up now and then.
Joggy Mike Manganiello joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Mike, you were a steward in Texas, and I do believe, were you a steward at River Downs as well?
Yeah, River Downs. I worked as a steward in Texas, River Downs, Ellis Park in Kentucky, DRC in Michigan, Hoosier Park in Indiana, and at River Downs.
But didn't you spend some time as a trainer as well?
Yes, in 79, I quit riding and went to training horses. And I trained for 5 years and decided I wanted to go back to riding, which I did. So that was 1984. So I went back to ride in 1984 and rode until I retired in 1991.
And what was that transition like, going from riding races to then taking that time to train? Obviously you missed it because eventually you went back, but
right. Well, training, it was kind of exciting to start training, but I was glad I did it, because it gave me a little more insight as to what trainers have to deal with, which I really wasn't aware of as much as I thought I was. And it's a 24/7 job. You have to train your horses. You have to train your owners. I mean, there's just there's a lot to it, and it was a whole lot easier riding horses than training horses. So,
I like that you said train the owners as well.
Yeah. I mean, you had a lot of training to do there, but it's a tough job, and you know, I take my hats off to these trainers, because they've got a tough way to go, and but it was a good experience for me. I did quite well as a trainer. You know, I mean, didn't break any records, but I won my share of races, and I was a lot happier riding than I was training.
Mm. Yeah, I've always said, for us riding, we get a horse for, you know, 2 minutes, and the trainers are stuck with them.
Yeah, they are. We get to go out for the next race and try to win a race. Trainers got to wait till the next 2 weeks, you know.
Exactly.
It's a tough job. It really is.
And did you train at the same circuit, that Kentucky-Florida circuit?
Yes, I did. I went to, you know, stayed in Kentucky, and went to Tampa in the wintertime. You know, shipped up, run up in Chicago a little bit, and run down at Gulfstream Park. But mostly the same circuit I did when I was riding.
And then you said for 5 years you trained, and it was a tough job, and then eventually you decided to come back. And what was the trigger that initiated that?
Well, you know, I always did miss the riding part of it when I was training. And I guess as I got tired of steady work and worry, and I didn't want to have to deal with it no more. So that kind of was a turning point for me.
Definitely makes sense. Mike, we only have a couple, 2 minutes left here, and I can't believe how fast time is flying. Now I want to ask you, what are you doing now?
I'm retired. I'm just kind of laying around, being lazy, and just doing whatever I feel like doing.
Nothing
wrong. Doing a little traveling, you know.
Nothing wrong with that. And you mentioned traveling. Do you have any other hobbies?
Not really, other than fishing. I really like fishing, and you know, I plan on maybe doing some of that in the summer. and riding motorcycle. You know, I love riding my motorcycle.
Motorcycles, that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. You get to go from riding racehorses to iron horses.
Exactly. I know sometimes I catch myself driving and, you know, trying to strategize and weave through traffic. And unfortunately, I've had quite a few speeding tickets. Do you get pulled over a lot, Mike?
Not a lot, but I have my share of pullovers.
Too funny, Mike. Just tell him, tell him you can't help it. You need that adrenaline rush. What do you do?
Yeah, you do.
You know, and are you married, Mike?
Yes, I am. I'm married to Kitty, and that's my wife, and we've been married 3 years now, and we're quite happy together here.
Well, Mike, we're all out of time. You and Kitty enjoy traveling and riding your motorcycles, and just thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Folks, if you missed any portion of tonight's show, check out our website. That's horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. While you're there, don't forget to check out all of our other great shows. You can listen to Trainer Talk, Equine Forum, Express Bet Radio, the list goes on. And join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time on Tuesday with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Dallapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.